Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth. My name is Lauren Litton and I'm the host of the show. Spotlight on Youth is dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. It is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That is 347-994-1149, and then you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you'll be placed in a queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Today we are talking about the use, or really the misuse, of isolation. Unless people are entrenched in corrections or juvenile justice work, isolation is not something that is widely discussed, but it is frequently raised in investigations and litigation around the treatment and conditions youth are subjected to when confined in secure settings such as detention and state correctional facilities. Many reasons have been put forth as to why isolation may be used, for example, behavior modification or the protection of vulnerable youth. However, research shows that placing youth in isolation has the opposite effect and, in fact, can be detrimental and harmful. Today, Dr. Marty Beyer and Professor Sandra Simpkins are here to discuss isolation, the impact and consequences of its use, and help us brainstorm how to keep kids placed in secure settings safe. So let me do some quick introductions before we get to our discussion. Dr. Marty Beyer works as a juvenile justice and child welfare consultant. Her work focuses on the impact of immature thinking, identity trauma and disabilities on youth offenses, and Miranda incompetency. Marty has assisted numerous states and community organizations in designing effective services for children and youth, including implemented strengths, needs-based child welfare practices, and mental health services. Marty has published widely on these topics, including Juvenile Boot Camps Don't Make Sense and Experts for Juveniles at Risk of Adult Sentences, and she is a contributor to two forthcoming books, Promoting Health and Well-Being in the Juvenile Justice System and Children of Incarcerated Parents, Developmental and Clinical Issues. She holds a doctorate in clinical community psychology from Yale University. Professor Sandra Simpkins is the Director of Clinical Programs and the co-director of the Children's Justice Clinic at Rutgers Camden School of Law. She is a national trainer on the issue of girls in the juvenile justice system and is involved in conditions of confinement reform. Sandra is also the co-director of the Northeast Region Juvenile Defender Center, a subsidiary of the National Juvenile Defender Center, where she provides consultation and training to child advocates in Delaware, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. Prior to joining the Rutgers faculty in 2006, she spent 15 years working in criminal and juvenile defense and served as assistant chief of the juvenile unit at the Defender Association of Philadelphia. Sandra has published numerous articles and has a book currently under contract titled When Kids Get Arrested, What Every Adult Should Know. So, Sandra, Marty, I would like to welcome you to the show. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
So I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. I've been using this term isolation. Sandra, maybe you can explain, what does that mean when we're talking about its use in juvenile detention and commitment facilities?
It's really simple. It means when you take a kid and you put him in a cell away from everybody else and you leave him there for long periods of time during the day. So that's really the working definition I want to use about isolation, just removing a kid and putting him away in a cell away from, you know, all the other people who are in the facility. I have to say that, like you, I'm new to isolation. I've been a juvenile defender for many years, and I've been passionate about post-disposition representation, and that means what happens to kids once they go into juvenile facilities. But isolation is a new issue for me to focus on, and in fact, if it wasn't for my experience with one of my clients, whose name was Troy, I would have not, you know, gotten so deeply involved in isolation and how it's used in juvenile facilities. And if it's okay, I just want to describe a little bit about my experience with my client, Troy, because I think it illuminates a lot of the problems and issues that occur.
So, definitely, you know, please do.
I've been doing this for a long time, and I've never seen anything like this. I'll never forget the day I went to meet my 15-year-old client. He was in a secure facility, and when the guards brought him out, he was shackled in three places, his wrist to his stomach, and in leg irons. And what was remarkable to me is that he wasn't wearing clothes, really. He didn't have a prison jumpsuit on. Rather, he was in this Velcro gown that was held together with some straps. It was actually painful to watch him try to sit down in a chair because he didn't have on shoes, he had on flip-flops, and with the handcuffs, it was really difficult. I asked one of the guards if Troy could have his hands cuffed in front of him, and they did comply. And when the arms, when his arms were put in front of him, what I saw were numerous self-mutilation marks, really too many to count, in various states of healing. I asked Troy why he was dressed like this and, you know, what was going on. And he told me that he had been put in the box. I asked him what the box meant, and he told me that it was basically solitary and that he had been in this box for nearly 6 months. I quickly got some information, and I went out to the parking lot, and I frankly couldn't believe what I had heard. I even called my husband. I said, "You're not going to believe what I just heard." But in fact, documents later confirmed what Troy said. He, in fact, had been in an isolation cell for 24 hours a day for 180 of the 225 days he was in this facility. And I just want to take a second to describe this cell. The cell was 7 feet by 7 feet. There was a mattress but no sheets, just a sink and a toilet, and a small sealed window near the ceiling. And there was literally nothing else permitted in his cell. All of his meals were there. There was no school or books. There was no exercise. The only time he was allowed out was to get a shower. After getting the documents and, you know, visiting Troy, I filed an emergency court motion for his immediate release, and days later he was transferred to a psychiatric hospital. But it wasn't until I discovered Troy's situation that I learned how pervasive the isolation is in juvenile facilities.
That is a story exactly illuminates the issue. And Sandra, I'm going to just ask you to speak up just a little bit.
Sure.
Great. And for our listeners, if you hear coughing in the background, Marty, who is one of our guests, is graciously on, even though she's not feeling so well. I don't know, Marty, was there anything you wanted to add to that?
No, I think Sandra has defined it well and told us a sad story, but not an unusual story in juvenile facilities of many, many days of isolation that can happen to girls and boys, both in detention and commitment facilities.
Fortunately, through the work of the National Juvenile Defender Center, once I, you know, discovered Troy's situation, I did have access to a lot of fabulous colleagues, specifically the Juvenile Law Center, and I consulted with them. Troy's case is actually posted on this blog if you want to read the federal court's opinion, and that case is currently in federal litigation.
Great. And what Sandra means is that we have posted two cases to the radio show on Children's Law's website, so you can check that out at www.childrenslawky.org, and I'll give that link at the end again. So for what purposes and to what extent is isolation being used in detention or correctional facilities?
That is such a great question, because one of the challenges we find is that they don't call it isolation. The term isolation is rarely used, but the act of it, the removing a child away and putting them in a cell without schooling, without access to counseling, happens frequently. But it's called different things. For example, we've heard this type of thing called pre-hearing confinement, protective custody, seclusion, behavior modification, close watch, room restriction, segregation. I mean, all of these different terms are used for the concept of isolation. And it's used, you know, it's used in extreme situations, like, you know, when there's something extreme going on in a facility. But it's also, from my perspective, way too often for all kinds of minor offenses. We have situations where clients were being mouthy and they were put in the box, or clients wrote on a wall and they were put in segregation, or they were cursing. All kinds of minor offenses children end up being in these isolation situations, which are very harmful to their mental health.
So, and you just mentioned it's harmful to their mental health. Why, you know, what are the psychological consequences of isolation? Why are these practices concerning?
Well, one of the surprising things is that as far as we've been able to find, there hasn't been any research about the effects of isolation on kids in juvenile detention and commitment facilities. There's quite a lot of research about the harmful consequences of isolation for adults, and two highly thought of mental health professionals, Dr. Grassian and Dr. Haney, have published their accounts of adult prisoners' reactions to isolation, including that adults with whom they have worked clinically and in their research studies, who either both adult prisoners who had pre-existing mental health problems and those who didn't have any, when they were placed in isolation, developed very severe psychiatric syndromes that included hearing voices, having panic attacks, having an inability to tolerate ordinary stimuli. And that many of these prisoners who were isolated for long periods of time suffered permanent psychological harm as a result of that confinement and had great difficulty with normal social interaction after they either rejoined the rest of the inmate population when they were released from isolation or when they were released in the community. But surprisingly, no one has done similar research with juveniles in isolation, despite the widespread use of isolation among juveniles. In my experience, isolating juveniles has a number of very harmful psychological consequences. Putting youth in isolation often causes depression, particularly if they're in the circumstance that Sandra described with her client Troy, if they've been denied reading materials, if they're not getting out of confinement for exercise and interacting with others. Being alone and having nothing to do gives youth too much time to ruminate about their problems and whether or not they were depressed before they got isolated. Usually they will become depressed, or if they were before, more depressed by being alone and having nothing to do. Secondly, isolating juveniles causes agitation. They view isolation as unfair, and when they feel unfairly treated, they can become angry, and they lose their faith in adults who they are dependent upon to treat them with unfairness. Lots of kids who are in isolation protest the unfairness of their situation, and they might be getting very angry, banging on the door, creating some other kind of commotion to draw attention to how unhappy they are being isolated. Third, isolating juveniles can make them feel victimized, and for kids who have been previously victims, this can be re-traumatizing and have a variety of negative psychological effects. So if a kid feels that the adult is abusing their power by locking them in a room, and if that young person has been previously victimized by adults, then the sense of betrayal that they experience and their anger may flood them with painful memories, with very strong feelings about the adults who are confining them. And those feelings may be really overwhelming to a young person, especially if they have no one they can talk to while they're in isolation. Fourth, isolating juveniles causes an increased risk of suicide. And Lindsay Hayes has done some research about juveniles who commit suicide and attempt suicide in juvenile facilities. Half of those kids in his studies who committed suicide while incarcerated in a juvenile facility were in isolation at the time of their suicide. That's a horrifying finding. But again, for a kid who's depressed, has nothing to do but think about their problems while they're isolated, there's a much greater risk that they will start having suicidal thoughts and may impulsively commit suicide while they are isolated. Just as a note here, many times we hear detention and commitment facilities say that they use isolation to, quote-unquote, protect suicidal juveniles, and that they watch suicidal juveniles by keeping them in a room where they can be observed and by stripping the room. But just the opposite treatment is what is warranted for a suicidal kid. Suicidal kids have to be around others, and they have to be involved in activities as ways of keeping them from thinking about hurting themselves or being able to commit suicide. And so it's very important for facilities not to have isolation as part of their approach to handling suicidal juveniles, but instead to watch them all of the time to prevent suicide while they're out in population doing normal activities.
I just want to jump in here for a second and just say anecdotally that, you know, that is what we found, is that this isolation is being used as a mental health treatment, which is really extraordinary because we've known since 1787 that isolation is harmful and makes things worse.
And I think one of the problems that we find is that mental health professionals in juvenile facilities are part of this decision to use isolation, possibly because they don't find that the facility is able to protect vulnerable youth adequately while the kids are out doing regular activities. But if that's the case, there are a lot of other mental health approaches, which we'll talk about later, to address the emotional needs of kids who are in juvenile facilities, and those should be done without resorting to isolation, because isolation isn't protective. As Sandra said, it's harmful to kids psychologically. A fifth really important harm of isolation in juvenile facilities is that kids are often denied education. So they're in isolation 24/7 or 23/7, and sometimes they are brought their books or they are allowed to do homework, but of course that's not participating in an educational program, and often they are not. allowed to have books and continue to work on anything they were working on in the facility school. So this
one is... One of the reasons this education piece is particularly egregious is that so many of the children actually have been identified as eligible for special education services. And so they really get off track. It's been our experience that sometimes kids just get dittos or handouts under the cell, and that's supposed to count as education.
And so for those kids that Sandra's referring to who have been identified as eligible for special ed, it's really clear under the IDEA that they are not allowed to be excluded from their educational program. And of course, we can talk more about all the things that are available under the IDEA to make sure that those kids are not isolated and excluded from school. But of course, there are large numbers of kids in juvenile facilities who should have been identified as eligible for special ed and haven't been or haven't yet been. And
just to be clear about the numbers, I mean, we're talking over 50%. Like over 50% of kids in a facility have been classified as special education. It's that high.
And more may well be eligible but haven't been classified. And so, of course, the facility is required to identify those youth as eligible for special ed. But then for the group of kids who are not eligible for special ed, because they don't have education-related disabilities, it's still harmful to take them out of school, either in detention or in a long-term juvenile facility, because it's inconsistent with the state's responsibility for care and rehabilitation, as well as being against state law regarding their being in school. And so this is an important harm, that kids lose a great deal when they're not allowed to read, when they're not allowed to do their school projects, when they're not allowed to progress in education, which is a high priority of many kids who are in detention and commitment facilities, and, of course, when they are excluded from the social benefits of attending school. And common to all of these harms that I've described is the fact that a kid in isolation is a kid who is not out interacting with peers and interacting with adults. And that's an important part of adolescent development, are the social relationships and social learning that kids have from those interactions. Lastly, in the area of harm, I just wanted to point out that younger juveniles are at even higher risk of harm from isolation. So kids who are 15, 14, and younger require a lot more individual attention just to be able to tolerate institutional life. They have even less emotional maturity than older kids, and as a result, they don't have the emotional ability to be alone for long periods of time, and without any individual attention for their needs. The younger youth tend to deteriorate even more than older youth who are in isolation.
Great. Thank you, Marty, that you clearly outlined all the issues that arise with the use of isolation. We do have a question from a listener, John, who asks, though, if there is ever a time that isolation can be used safely. And I know you were both were going to talk about some standards around its use, so maybe you can tie that into that question.
I'll take the first stab, and maybe Marty wants to follow up, but I do think that isolation, if it's really limited, can be safely used. And I just want to point out the juvenile, the Annie E. Casey has a set of standards under their Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, which says the standards for isolation should not be longer than 4 hours. There are other standards. The Department of Justice standards relating to corrections administration says that it should never be longer than 24 hours. The American Correctional Association actually says there can be a maximum of 5 days. And so you can see that there are standards all over the map. The more recent standards from the Annie E. Casey Foundation do say 4 hours. And the case, you know, and so I can see that there could be times where you temporarily want to separate a child, but days and days and days on end is really going to cause a lot of harm.
I would jump in and say that facilities may have trouble clarifying the purpose of their current use of isolation. So a 4-hour isolation, as the Casey Foundation has set out, might be construed as isolation to interfere with something dangerous. So it's a temporary way of separating a kid from a dangerous situation, and then to fix that situation so that it's not dangerous for the kid to leave isolation and go back into the regular unit. But these lengthy stays in isolation, longer than 4 hours, longer than 24 hours, are really punishment. And they
Marty, can I jump in for a second?
Yeah.
In my experience, I think that sometimes the facility administrators have good intentions. I mean, they want to keep a particular child safe, or, you know, a kid has an injury and they want to make sure that they heal properly. The problem is that I don't think there's a full awareness of the psychological harm when you put a kid in medical isolation for a week, or you're trying to protect the kid and you put them in protective custody for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks at a time. And so even if there's good intentions, I think there really needs to be much more awareness about how you're damaging the kid when you're separating them from the population.
So I think that's a good point. If it's not being used as punishment, but for the reasons that you said, where there is some thinking on the part of the staff that it would be a benefit for a kid, it would be protective for a kid, then at the very least, addressing these harms, recognizing we're doing something that we think is protecting the kid, but in doing it, we're going to harm the kid. Is there any way for us to protect this kid and keep him from getting depressed, keep him from getting agitated, keep her from feeling victimized, keep her from having an increased risk of suicide, keep him or her involved in the educational program to which they're entitled? And there are many ways for a facility to make sure that those harms are prevented while at the same time protecting a kid.
And we had a question from Rebecca that sort of fits to what you're talking about now, but you can let me know if you want to address it later. She's indicating that the use of isolation, especially in detention facilities in her state, have increased tremendously, it seems like, in the last few years. And she wants to know, what can people on the ground really do to help illuminate the issues and understanding the damaging effects from outside, you know, if you're not working in the facility itself?
So I think those are two separate questions.
Okay.
One is, what can you do from the outside, and the other... And maybe, Sandra, you want to talk a little bit about that, but then there's the question of what institutional changes could occur in programming that would address what may be some of the reasons for what the caller is describing as a substantial increase. And I could talk a little bit about that, but, Sandra, I know you have a lot to say on that subject, too.
So I just want to make sure that I understand the question right. The question is, what can an outsider do about the substantial increase in the use of isolation? Is that right?
How can we all increase public awareness about this, the damaging effects, you know, and especially if you're working on these issues but not within the correctional facilities?
Well, I mean, I think this is a great question. Obviously, the juvenile defenders have an extremely critical role to play. Juvenile defenders really need to visit the children who are in detention centers and in facilities because that's where you get the information. Unfortunately, because of, you know, caseloads and other pressures, lawyers are not visiting kids once they're placed in juvenile facilities. And I cannot emphasize enough how incredibly critical it is. Once that kid leaves juvenile court and goes into a facility, they really are out of sight, out of mind. And just like any insulated organization, there's a culture there, and unless outside people come in and ask questions and there's some independent oversight, you just don't know what's going on. So my first point is that juvenile defenders have a critical role in trying to visit their clients in facilities. The other thing is that parents can take a role. I mean, if you have a child or you know of a child who's in a facility, visiting is the best thing you can do. I've written a lot about this. You know, lately I like to say, you just don't know if you don't go. You have to go and visit your client or your child to really understand and ask those questions. I mean, so when the kid tells you, I'm in SEG or I'm in close watch, what does that mean? And if it sounds like isolation, you should be worried that child might be being harmed. So I think that parents have a role. And lawyers and anybody who's interested in children, I mean, if there's a way that you can visit and find out more information and do some independent oversight of what's actually going on in the facilities. And then once you find out, you need to make other people aware because I think that the systems are receptive to change. Systems will change, you know, once they're more aware that these types of practices are harming kids.
Great. Thanks.
So if I can pick up and talk
sure.
a little bit about what a facility, a juvenile detention or commitment facility, can do to prevent some of the behaviors to which isolation is sometimes a response. I would like to, because I think this is another area where outsiders can be very effective, is drawing attention to not only the practices of isolation in the facility, but that in large part, probably without intending it, facility staff are contributing to the behavior problems that then lead to, of the kids, that then lead to the use and abuse of isolation. And I think the starting point is first to understand that the majority of youth who come into juvenile facilities are kids who have experienced trauma. And kids who are traumatized, both from past physical and sexual abuse, but also from multiple placements, from the death of important people in their lives, exposure to violence. Kids who are traumatized require staff who understand the continuing effects of trauma on adolescents and who recognize that traumatized kids tend to react when they feel threatened. And that those reactions can cause reactions in other kids, can make other kids and staff feel vulnerable because of the aggression that is seen in a lot of kids who have trauma that hasn't been treated.
And you know what? And some of this is really a training issue because facilities need training resources and their staff to be trained, because if they had more understanding about these issues and about adolescent development, they may be able to respond differently.
I agree. I mean, the usual adult reaction when a kid is acting up is punishment, and that increases the probability that these problem behaviors are going to continue and are going to increase. And so we often see in facilities staff who don't want to be caught up in a cycle, but they are involved in a cycle of the residents acting up, causing a staff reaction, which is perceived by the residents as provocation, which gets an angry reaction from the kid, and it just goes on and on and on. It is often these young people who are put in isolation, and then they have the kind of psychological deterioration and isolation that I described, making them very difficult to return to the population, or when they are returned, then there's even more fuel for this angry cycle with staff and with other residents to occur. So it's very important for staff to be trained on avoiding this kind of power struggle with youth, to understand
and how to de-escalate, like
right.
specific techniques on how to de-escalate behavior without
yeah.
resort to just throwing them in the cell.
Exactly. I mean, you can a trained staff person can see when a kid is starting into the escalation of their behavior, and the adult's behavior will definitely determine whether the kid continues to escalate or is able to get calmed down and avoid any further altercations or reacting to provocation of other kids and staff. And many staff feel powerless because of the way that their unit of kids is into this kind of cycling up, escalating, and then kids being restrained, and then kids being put in isolation. And that has become a daily reality of the unit. But
I just want to comment. I do think that each facility has its own culture. I mean, there's a culture in every facility. And, you know, the leadership of that facility is really critical. But if the leadership can be aware of, you know, what we're talking about and these harmful effects and try to invest in some training of the staff, it can be really helpful.
I agree. And so I think even if a facility had forced on it a policy or a procedure that stopped the use of isolation or limited the use of isolation to in the ways that Sandra described earlier, I don't think staff would think that was realistic and would assume that the person who was behind those restrictions on the use of isolation was just unrealistic and had no idea what it was like to be on the unit. And so it's really important to make sure that there is adequate programming designed for kids who have high needs for educational services and high needs for individual attention and needs for trauma treatment. Make sure that those services are there for kids, and that the unit staff are part of a whole team that is making sure that for every kid, staff of all types, unit staff, educators, recreation staff, as well as mental health staff, are in agreement with each other of how they will de-escalate that kid in order to prevent the kinds of behaviors that then can easily get out of control and lead to a use of isolation that will be harmful.
I just want to jump in and say, and it is possible. The reason I know it's possible is that, you know, I spent many years working in Pennsylvania where isolation was absolutely not an issue. At the juvenile detention center in Philadelphia, kids were not ever put in isolation, not the way we're talking about here that's happening in other states. And kids weren't allowed to be held in isolation for longer than 4 hours without a court order. And so some states have figured out a way to avoid the use of isolation. It absolutely is possible.
I'd like to give our call-in number again, which is 347 404-994-1149, and you would press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question. I do have a few more questions coming in from the chat room. And you may or may not know this, so feel free to say you don't know, but you talked about, you know, it's harmful and that there's much more research on the adult side and not as much on the juvenile side. What have you both looked at, or can you speak to how isolation is being used with youth who are in the adult system, adult facilities, and has that been studied at all?
I just know anecdotally. I just know from a couple of stories that youth who are waived into the adult court and are in adult jails are experiencing isolation as well. I do not know if any research has been done on them.
Okay. I don't either, and I'm not aware of the work of Dr. Grassian or Dr. Haney that they separated out the age of the adult prisoners who they were studying in their research, which might well have included individuals under 18, but they might not have been separately studied.
Okay,
I do want to add though that I think that this is a new issue for a lot of people to think about. I recently gave a speech, and after the speech, I got several emails from people from North Carolina, from West Virginia, saying that once they heard me talking about the harmful effects of isolation, they went back to the facilities and asked some questions and were able to identify other children who had been put in these types of conditions for many months. So I think that, you know, it just takes people to start asking the questions.
Well, that's sort of a good segue into maybe what are those questions and what else can, you mentioned defenders before, what else can children's attorneys and advocates do post-disposition to ensure that there's fair treatment and safety of youth?
Yes, I mean, post-disposition is so critical. So I think there's, you know, one thing I wanted to say is that many states don't have automatic review hearings. And so regardless of the length of sentence, when a kid leaves the courtroom and is placed somewhere, there's no check-in. There's no way for the judge to really find out what's going on. There's no feedback loop, you know, of information. And in those states that don't have review hearings, it's even more important for defenders to try to find a way to visit their clients. Even if you just visited one kid one time, that could potentially make a difference. So the post-disposition piece is really important. In terms of the questions to ask once you get there, I mean, kids adjust, sadly, to really any reality. For them, it's just their world. But in order to find out what's actually going on, you need to ask the kid, you know, where are you? How frequently, you know, do you go to school? Figure out what that kid's daily routine is. But you want to ask questions about their access to a mental health counselor, how many days they spend in school, if they are in some kind of segregation, are they getting daily exercise, are they getting to eat their meals with other people, how long, how many hours a day are they in that cell. Those are the kinds of detailed questions you need to ask, because the kids are probably not going to tell you they're in isolation. They're just going to say, I'm on watch, you know. And so it's really getting underneath their language and understanding more about the reality of their days that can help defenders be powerful advocates.
And of course, everything that Sandra said applies to juvenile detention as well.
Yes,
whether your kid is in a juvenile detention facility or in the adult jail pending hearings on the adult side, those same questions will help you find out whether your kid is in isolation while they're detained. And I agree with Sandra. Your kid might come into the interview with you complaining about the food, and because they've become so accustomed to being in isolation, they don't start out with, well, my biggest problem is I haven't been out of a cell for 180 days or 3 days, because they're going to talk about much more immediate things like the food or the shower conditions rather than realizing that it's really unacceptable and shouldn't be regular practice for a kid to be in isolation. They won't know to start there with you, as Sandra has said.
And so how around the country, whether it's in the detention or the state correctional facilities, what are some of the legal arguments that have been used and what's happening around the country around that?
I encourage anybody who's interested in this issue, you know, one of the first places you want to check out is the Department of Justice in Civil Rights Division. They have done many investigations over the years on juvenile facilities. And so in 2011, there was a DOJ Civil Rights Division investigation out of Florida. In 2010, there was Louisiana. 2007, Indiana. There was a recent report out of California in 2007, there was a big investigation against Ohio. So in reading the Department of Justice investigations, you're quickly going to pick up what the issues are and how isolation is overused by facilities across the country for a variety of reasons. In terms of the, you know, I just want to segue and say, as an individual juvenile defender, I mean, you can't take on an investigation like the Department of Justice, and you're not going to be able to litigate civil rights lawsuits. But one of the great lessons that we've learned here, you know, in working on the Troy case, is an individual defender can recognize the problem and then reach out to allies who can take on the bigger systemic issues. And so, you know, we were really able to have a collaboration with organizations like the Juvenile Law Center who could take on larger systemic issues as we identified what was going on in the facilities.
I think you both were talking about it earlier, and then we sort of moved into some other things, talking about what can be done to avoid the use of isolation. Is there more that you want to say about that?
I don't think I finished up on the legal arguments. I mean,
sure.
All of the use of isolation really goes. It's about the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. That's what the courts have said, that when you hold someone in isolation, it violates the Eighth Amendment. There are also 14th Amendment due process rights that get violated when a kid doesn't have access to school or services or those kinds of things. But a lot of that is in the Department of Justice investigations. Some of the key cases that we've found are actually old cases from the 70s that recognize that confining a child in a cell with little in the way of education or reading material would absolutely rot away his body and his mind and his spirit. Now, we knew this in the 70s. Unfortunately, these kinds of conditions still exist today. But Lawless versus the State Department, New York State Department of Social Services is one particular case. The inmates of the Boys Training School versus Affleck is another case. And we can post this on your blog as well.
Great. Marty, anything you want to add?
Well, I agree with Sandra that if you wanted to make a change in the way a facility was programming for kids to meet their needs in a developmentally sound way, in a trauma-responsive way, whether they were a detention or commitment facility, that sounds like taking on a very big project. But once you started working on even one young person who was isolated and you discovered that this was a regular detention or commitment facility practice, I think you would find that you will have many allies who are interested in helping the facility change its programming, change its training, and change its policies.
Okay. Well, we have about 10 minutes left, so I want to make sure there was nothing else you did want to add about practices that you see as emerging, promising practices in detention and commitment facilities.
Marty, there were a couple of model practices that are being experimented with in some of the states. Do you want to talk about those?
Well, I think there are some positive programs that are occurring in juvenile detention and commitment facilities. There may be something promising happening in in your state, wherever you are practicing. So I don't think we should just think about the promising practices that have been getting attention. One of the ones that I'm aware of is the implementation of the New York model in New York commitment facilities for juveniles, and that is a developmentally sound, trauma responsive approach to commitment services for juveniles that wasn't specifically designed to prevent isolation, but really focuses staff attention on de-escalating youth and avoiding restraint, and providing a safe environment where kids aren't afraid, where staff aren't afraid, and where kids' needs can be quickly responded to, so that the problem behaviors that often lead to isolation are being addressed. So that's an example of an emerging system response to a more adequate juvenile facility program. But I'm sure that there are a number of others across the country.
Two others that I'm aware of is, one is approach used by the Maine Youth Development Center. They're using something called the collaborative problem-solving approach that was developed by Dr. Stuart Albin of Massachusetts General Hospital. And this has, you know, the research has shown so far that it has had great success in reducing the use of isolation and restraint in juvenile facilities. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that as word spreads and success spreads in these, new approaches, that more facilities will take the risk in trying something new.
I know I just read today that OJJDP and the MacArthur Foundation have funded several national organizations for technical assistance, and one is the National Center for Mental Health and Juvenile Justice to do specific training for detention corrections personnel.
Oh, so, that's great.
Yeah, so it seems like this is a very timely issue. Both of you have mentioned other resources and cases, and that you're willing to send it to us so we can post it. Are there other resources or organizations that you can think of that you want to mention now to share with our listeners?
I just want to mention this great report produced by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. It's called No Place for Kids: The Case for Reducing Juvenile Incarceration. It really is a great report filled with a lot of statistics nationally about the over-reliance on isolation and restraint, and also how dangerous many of these facilities are.
Yeah, right. Okay, well then I guess it's time to turn to final thoughts that you want to share with our listeners. And Sandra, also there was a question that came in to see if there was any sort of could give a little bit more information about final outcomes for Troy.
Troy is doing really, really well. I'm actually pleased to say that. I can report great progress, and it's it really warms my heart that things have turned around for him. Was removed from that isolation setting and has continued to improve, so he's doing well.
Great. Is there anything any final thoughts you want to share just about on this issue?
Just that if you're a defender, make time to see your kid. Make time to see your client. That's really my number one takeaway point, is that you don't know if you don't show up and talk to the kid in the facility. You just really don't know what's going on.
Marty?
I support that wholeheartedly.
Okay. You think you can get away with that, huh? Very well. I want to thank you both so much for being on the show. It was wonderful information and gave us all a lot to think about. Will, speaking about Ohio, Will Harrell will be our guest on the next episode, and Will is the appointed monitor in SHV Reed, formerly SHV Stickrath, where he monitors the implementation of the settlement stipulation reached in a federal class action based on the unconstitutional conditions of confinement of youth who were housed in Ohio state correctional facilities. And he's going to discuss his role as monitor and the findings and recommendations put forth in the annual report that was recently filed with the federal court. So to stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can follow us here at blogtalkradio.com or visit Children's Law Center website, which again is www.childrenslawky.org. So take care, and I'll see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Marty, Sandra, thank you so much again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.